Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the host of How We Survive. It's a podcast from Marketplace. In 1986, before I was a journalist, I was flying for the Navy.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
It was the Cold War, and my first deployments were intercepting Russian bombers. Today, though, there's another threat out there. Climate change.
This could be the warmest year on record.
Climate change is here.
Temperatures here are warming faster than anywhere on Earth.
And while the threat seems new, the Pentagon's been funding studies on climate change since the 1950s.
I think we will put our troops and our forces at higher risk if we don't recognize the impact of climate change.
This season, we go to the front lines of the climate crisis to see how the military is preparing for the threat. Listen to How We Survive, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Israeli military is still fighting Hamas, carrying out a major operation in northern Gaza.
This is an area, by the way, that the Israeli military has already fought in twice since the October 7 massacre last year, and this is now the third time.
I'm Marco Werman. Ahead this hour, what's changed and what hasn't in Israel's campaign in Gaza. Also in Japan, the government says the country needs more kids. But not enough people want to be parents. We hear from young Japanese about their reasons why. Plus,
we're destroying species much, much quicker than they would normally go extinct.
A UN conference tries to get real about ambitious goals to protect biodiversity. Plus, a large pepperoni with a side of cocaine. A German drug bust takes down a shady pizzeria in Düsseldorf. All that and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Carolyn Beeler is on assignment today. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is back in the Middle East this week. It's his 11th visit to the region since October of last year. On Tuesday, he met with Israeli officials in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. At the top of his agenda was the unfinished war in the Gaza Strip. Speaking with reporters at Ben-Gurion Airport earlier today, Blinken said that Israel has achieved most of its strategic objectives in Gaza by dismantling Hamas militarily and killing most of its leadership, including the recent death of Yahya Sinwar.
Now is the time to turn those successes into an enduring strategic success. And there are really two things left to do. Get the hostages home and bring the war to an end with an understanding of what will follow.
Meanwhile, Palestinians in northern Gaza say the violence is getting more intense and that the Israeli military is pushing people out. A boy who gives his name as Kamal told the Palestinian Quds News Network he was fleeing Israeli troops. They rounded up people yesterday, he said, and made them sit in front of tanks. They separated women and children from the men and then beat up the Palestinian males. Accounts like this are adding to speculation that Israel is deliberately forcing thousands of Palestinians out of northern Gaza. Israeli officials have reportedly told Antony Blinken that this is not the government's policy. Amir Tibon has been reporting on this for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. He's also the author of a new book called The Gates of Gaza, a story of betrayal, survival, and hope in Israel's borderlands. Amir, what is Israel's military strategy in northern Gaza right now?
We are hearing contradicting messages from the government, the military, and politicians who are perhaps not in the most senior positions in the government, but do have a lot of influence. The official line of the government and the military is that this is a tactical operation right now in an attempt to root out Hamas cells and infrastructure in a specific area of northern Gaza. This is an area, by the way, that the Israeli military has already fought in twice since the October 7 massacre last year. And this is now the third time it is entering the Jabalia area in northern Gaza. And supposedly, this is a limited operation meant to dismantle and remove Hamas's presence over there. But you do have other voices within the military and parts of the government who are seeking something much larger than this. And they have some kind of a plan. You can call it a plan. It's not completely thought out, but it is a plan to remove all the civilians from this area. This is hundreds of thousands of people. And to do it by causing them to leave via denying all humanitarian assistance to this area.
Yeah, and there's some concern over how solid that military plan is. This is a military plan apparently written by a former Israeli general that spells out moving the entire Palestinian civilian population south. I mean, how real is that? And is that what's being acted upon?
I think that's the main concern, that if this plan would actually be implemented, Israel would face a lot of international criticism over it. There would be legal questions related to it. And I want to remind everyone that we are already facing an ongoing process at the International Criminal Court and at the International Court of Justice related to the war in Gaza. And so this plan would definitely put Israel in a much more difficult place in terms of the international legal situation. You know, on the one hand, the prime minister and the senior leaders of the military saying this is not the plan. The problem is right afterwards, we hear other ministers in the government and mid-level commanders in the military say the exact opposite. And we are all left with more question marks than answers at this point.
Yeah, and additionally, some far-right Israeli politicians say they want to rebuild Jewish settlements in Gaza and they want Palestinians to voluntarily leave. How much concern is there right now that this is the end game of what we're seeing in northern Gaza?
Well, that's the thing. If you're implementing this plan to remove the civilian population, the most logical reason to do it would be in order to make room for the construction of new Jewish settlements over there. Now, it has to be said, this was not the original reason that we went to war against Hamas. The reasoning to go to war was because of what Hamas had done on October 7 and to make sure it could never happen again. And of course, to release the hostages. And if right now we have pressure from within the government to rewrite the goals of the war and to turn this into some kind of a campaign to reestablish Jewish settlements in the Gaza Strip, well, this is something that obviously is a big concern for the United States and for other countries that support Israel, but it's also not supported by many of the Israeli public.
Also, what does it suggest to you that Israel, according to most reports, is not allowed in any humanitarian aid in northern Gaza since the beginning of October?
The word any is too strong. There was a pause and there were difficulties, but after pressure from the United States and other countries, Israel has allowed more aid to come in. And I think, again, this is a testament to this internal fight within the Israeli system over the strategy of the war between the people who want to implement this starvation policy to drive out the population and those who are saying, we're not going to do that. We have tactical aims right now here to dismantle Hamas in Jabalia, and we're going to focus on that and bring in sufficient amounts of aid to support the rest of the population. Hamas as a military organization no longer exists in the Gaza Strip. Israel dismantled the different brigades and battalions that made up Hamas, but it still exists as a guerrilla force. And what we're going to keep seeing is that every few months, the Israeli military will have to return to places where Israel had already fought and lost soldiers, because Hamas will reinstill its rule unless we actually have a strategy to replace Hamas with a different government.
Jabalia, that's a very large refugee camp in northern Gaza. So months ago, Amir, Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu said the war's objectives in Gaza were close to being achieved, but obviously it's still not over, and it doesn't seem like reaching these stated goals even matters right now. So what's it going to take to bring this war in Gaza to an end?
Yeah, Netanyahu has stopped saying that. He's not talking about a short war anymore. Politically for him, it's very convenient that the war is ongoing because that is keeping at bay all the anger and the disillusionment by many Israelis over the failures of October 7. And I think at the end of the day, what we need in order to end this war, we need much more pressure on both Hamas and Netanyahu to reach a deal, release the hostages from the hands of Hamas, end the war, and bring us back to some kind of a situation where we can start rebuilding from this.
I mean, you said Hamas only exists now as a guerrilla force, and Netanyahu's strategy in Gaza seems to be scorched earth. What can you imagine the international community will do in reaction to what seems like a really disproportionate response?
I think the results of the American election will have an impact here. Again, I think Netanyahu is betting everything on Trump, and we'll see in 2 weeks if he got it right. But that's his calculation right now, that if Trump will win, he will be able to continue this war as much as he wants.
Amir Tibon is an Israeli journalist and the author of The Gates of Gaza, a story of betrayal, survival, and hope in Israel's borderlands. He spoke with us from Nahal Oz in southern Israel. Some of Europe's most violent terrorists could soon be released from jail years earlier than expected. We're talking about members of the now disbanded Basque separatist group, ETA. Over a period of several decades, ETA killed more than 800 people in Spain. Incarcerated militants from the group are likely to be freed early because of a European Union sentencing guideline that Spain has just adopted. The rule says that any prison time served abroad must also count toward their sentences at home. From Barcelona, the world's Jerry Haddon explains.
The other day in Spain's Congress, socialist Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez was talking immigration, his plans to control it, and so on. It's a big subject in Europe these days. But then, bigger news walked through the door. Those applause were not for Sánchez, but for a neatly dressed, middle-aged woman with short blonde hair named Marimar Blanco. She's a congresswoman with the opposition, the center-right Popular Party. And 27 years ago, ETA killed her brother. In 1997, ETA's violent drive for Basque independence was in full swing. In July that year, ETA commandos kidnapped 29-year-old Miguel Ángel Blanco, a small-town conservative politician, Marimar's brother. The militants had a demand that all jailed ETA members, including some in France, be moved to prisons in the Basque country. When that didn't happen, they shot Blanco in the head twice and dumped his body on a road. The trigger man, Francisco Javier García Gastelú, alias Chapote. Chapote fled to France, where many ETA members used to hide. The French eventually nabbed him, and Chapote spent 6 years in jail there before being extradited. And it's those 6 years that are stirring up a lot of emotions in Spain today. Because with the change in Spanish law this month, Chapote's 6 years in France will be applied as time served against his Spanish sentence. Up till now, prison time served abroad didn't count. ETA victims like Maite Araluce are outraged. She tells how one day when she was 15, back in 1976, she was eating lunch with her 8 siblings when their dad pulled up out front. While we were eating, she says, we heard the sound of machine guns. We ran to the balcony and could see our dad's car all shot up. He was in it with a driver. Behind him, a patrol car with 3 policemen as protection. ETA killed all 5 of them. Araluce is president of Spain's Victims of Terrorism Association. She says ETA's jailed assassins should not benefit from any penal reform. The new guidelines apply to some 40 ETA prisoners who've served in France. She says it will free some killers as early as next year. When the amendment passed, she says, our switchboard lit up like crazy. ETA victims were calling with panic attacks. They were asking if the person who killed their husband or son was going to be back on the street, if they were going to have to cross paths with them. Our team of psychologists, she says, have been working around the clock to help people cope. Araluce says PM Pedro Sánchez betrayed victims to stay in power. See, one of the partners in Sánchez's coalition government is Bildu, today's political wing of the Basque separatists. Without Bildu's backing, Sánchez's government collapses.
Al final, vemos que de aquí a unos años, todos los terroristas...
In a few years, the streets will be full of terrorists, Araluce says, while we victims continue serving our sentences. Because our pain has no statute of limitations, she says. We'll carry it with us until our deaths. ETA traumatized a generation of Spaniards, and even though the group disbanded under pressure some 14 years ago, any even perceived lenience toward them still strikes a nerve.
Es la pregunta que se hacen todos los vecinos. Aquí tienes una multa porque te multó, ¿no?
Que te vote Chapote, Sánchez. Que te vote Chapote.
During elections last year, when Sánchez teamed up with Bildu, conservative voters rallied behind this unlikely guy, an ordinary citizen named Chema de la Sierra. He shows up on Spanish TV, ostensibly for a news report about illegal radar traps on roads. But instead of talking tickets, Chema has a message. Sánchez, he says, que te vote Chapote. In other words, good luck in bed with the terrorists. It became a sort of slogan for conservatives, chanted at campaign events and rallies. Which brings us back to Spain's congressional session the other day, and all that clapping for Miguel Ángel Blanco's sister, Marimar, a victim of Chapote in flesh and blood. She stood defiantly in the chamber amidst her Popular Party colleagues, but the Popular Party was feeling anything but proud, because the sentencing reform that had just passed, they voted for it, by accident. No one in the party, it seems, read the amendment.
Si le queda un mínimo de conciencia,
if you have any conscience, scream Popular Party leader Alberto Feijóo at Sánchez, you'll retract the amendment before it becomes law. But it was too late. Sánchez, insisting Spain must abide by EU rules, did not retract the sentencing change. The Popular Party will be smarting for a long time and apologizing to ETA's victims. It needs them and their supporters to win back power one day, just as Sánchez needs the Basque Bildu Party to keep it. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Japanese government sees the next several years as the country's last chance to reverse a worrisome decline in the birth rate. Japan saw a record low number of births last year, and seeing that the country already has the oldest population on Earth, officials have come up with a new $24 billion a year strategy to encourage families to have more kids. But will that be enough? The World's Carolyn Beeler went to Japan to find out how policies like these factor into young women's decisions about whether to have children.
Yukumi Igarashi is a nurse in her mid-20s who's out shopping in downtown Tokyo on her day off. I ask her if she thinks she wants kids someday, and her answer comes quickly, no. If I think about the economic situation, if I were to have a baby, I couldn't make him or her happy, she says. To address financial concerns, just like Igarashi's, Japan last year increased the lump sum given to families when they have a baby to about $3,300. The government is also expanding the monthly child allowance this fall and has plans to do the same for school tuition breaks. Still, Igarashi says, even if they say they will help us with money, it wouldn't be enough. I spoke with about a dozen women, both with and without children, and none said the financial incentives were a significant part of their decision about having children. Data backs this up. Research spanning wealthy nations show that cash transfers don't raise fertility rates. Yuko Fujita is changing her newborn daughter Nina's diaper in the family's Tokyo apartment. The baby settles quickly, and Fujita dotes on her while we talk at the kitchen table.
Yes, she's so cute. She's perfect.
The baby is perfect, but Fujita doesn't think Japan is a perfect place to have a baby. In total, I'm not really satisfied with the government and corporate support, she tells me. Fujita points to high hospital fees for childbirth and a culture she sees as not very kid-friendly. Ultimately, for Yuko Fujita and her husband, Yuki, the decision to have Nina was deeply personal. I thought about having a child for myself, and I wanted a grandchild for my parents, but I never felt pressure to have a baby for the sake of the country. Yuki nods while his wife speaks. I never thought about it being for the nation, he says. I meet another parent at a playground in central Tokyo. Kaoru Akei is putting the sun hat back on her toddler's head for the umpteenth time this morning. She says the $130 they get per month as a child allowance doesn't help too much. What might make a difference, she says, is a shift in work culture in Japan. Because you can face negative opinions at work about taking maternity leave and childcare leave, she says, I would hesitate to announce I'm pregnant with a second baby. Also, the government encourages men to take childcare leave, but companies aren't following that, and male workers face stigma. Akei took an 8-month maternity leave after having her son. Her husband took just a few weeks off. That's typical here. Nationwide, more than 80% of new moms take maternity leave, almost always for more than 6 months. 30% of new dads take paternity leave, typically for a month or less. Labor economist Machiko Osawa says that won't change until workplaces do.
The corporate culture still prevent the men from taking childcare leave because the data shows that if you take childcare leave, they still suffer from a possibility of getting promoted or pay cut. etc.
The government is trying to change that culture with plans to boost already generous paid parental leave policies when both parents take time off. But once parental leave is over, grueling work hours at big corporate firms are a challenge.
You have to work really long hours to establish status in the workplace. But if you do that, difficult to raise children.
In Japan, moms spend more than 7 hours a day on housework and childcare combined. Dads spend a little more than an hour. Women often scale back their hours at work to make it all possible. But Osawa says that often comes with lifelong penalties to pay and career advancement in an economy where two incomes are necessary for most households.
Probably the social norm has to be changed so that the childcare burden has to be much more equally distributed among the couple. This is an issue that government has to tackle to increase the fertility rate.
Back at the packed Tokyo playground, kids barrel down slides and play chase with their parents. You can't see that Japan has a demographic problem, but it is something that is never far from leaders' minds. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler, Tokyo.
Fall can be a time to head inside and stay there, especially as night comes early and temps start to plummet. But people in the Netherlands say that's actually the perfect time to get yourself outside. In Dutch, there's a word for that, as the world's Bianca Hillier first explained in this story last year.
When the Dutch ask someone to go for a walk, they don't just say, hey, do you want to get some fresh air? Instead, they're much more poetic about it. Here's Caitlin Meyer, an assistant professor in Dutch linguistics at the University of Amsterdam.
You could say, kom, we gaan even uitwaaien.
The key word there is at the end of the sentence, uitwaaien.
Uitwaaien. The literal translation would be outblowing, or I guess in marginally better English, blowing out.
It doesn't mean taking a deep breath, though.
Think about blow away the cobwebs.
Nicolina van der Sees lives in Utrecht. She says uitwaaien is a Dutch verb for blowing away the cobwebs from your brain or clearing your head. You can do it by going on a walk or a hike, strolling along the beach, or even getting on a bike. But to properly go uitwaaien, there's one required element.
It's an activity where you are exposed to the wind.
Esme van der Hoeven, a Netherlands native, says uitwaaien is really used to make lemonade out of lemons.
The Netherlands is located, you know, next to the North Sea, and then it's very flat, so there's just always wind.
Might as well use it to blow out the cobwebs. Van der Hoeven, a lecturer of Dutch at UC Berkeley, says uitwaaien is the kind of word that grabs the attention of her students in the States.
Right? There are a lot of languages that have these words that we can't really translate into English. And that's fascinating, I think, for many people.
Caitlin Meyer points out one thing for sure. Don't mistake uitwaaien for exercise.
You'd go uitwaaien for the enjoyment of being outdoors and not for burning calories or getting your heart rate up or anything like that that you typically associate with exercise. It's more relaxing, right? Easy.
Even if you're not getting your heart rate up, going uitwaaien can still be good for your health. Research shows that time spent outdoors can reduce stress, improve cognition, and increase sleep quality. On that note, I think it's time for me to get out from behind my desk. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier, heading out the door to go uitwaaien.
The civil war in Sudan that began a year and a half ago has torn the country apart. It's killed tens of thousands of people and driven millions more from their homes.
This generation has the responsibility to answer the question of how we can live peacefully together as Sudanese.
We'll hear from a physician who's seen up close the human impact of Sudan's civil war. That's ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Peace with nature is the slogan, an aspirational one considering the current reality. We're talking about the COP16 conference on biological diversity being held in Colombia. Almost 200 countries are taking part, and none too soon because wildlife populations in much of the world are at a tipping point. According to the United Nations, our Earth is, quote, experiencing the largest loss of life since the dinosaurs. Tom Oliver is an ecologist at the University of Reading in the UK. I asked him first to define biodiversity loss.
So biodiversity loss is the degradation of nature, essentially, the loss of species, whether that's bees, butterflies, birds, or whether it's microbes and earthworms in the soil.
Yeah, and with a theme like peace with nature, it kind of suggests that we humans are responsible for a lot of the current lack of peace with nature. So fixing this is existential. What is the scale of biodiversity loss we're looking at right now?
So it is quite terrifying, actually. The background extinction rate is tens to hundreds of times higher than it was over the past 10 million years. So we're destroying species much, much quicker than they would normally go extinct. But of course, extinction is not the only thing that's important. Losing a species completely is very difficult. It matters how abundant those species are in the landscapes around us. And actually, places, for example, in Latin America, where the current conference of parties around this biodiversity issue is being held, estimates are that 94% of the population numbers of many species on average have been lost. So that's quite terrifying statistics on the level of decline from drivers such as deforestation and intensive farming. That's really what this conference is trying to address.
Wow. I mean, the way you describe the exponential decrease is really worrying. How do researchers like yourself come up with these numbers and also looking back in time for comparison? I mean, is there a census of every species, like ant, ape, elephant, or otherwise, and plants as well?
That's right. I mean, there's a number of censuses that exist. People have been tracking the numbers of these species, in some cases, right back into the 1970s. One of the issues is we focus on the kind of more charismatic species. So we have lots of information on vertebrate populations and birds and mammals, for example. We've got a lot less information on amphibians and also on insect populations. So the figures that I gave, Latin America is particularly damaged, but across the world, the average loss of population size is around 75%. But these estimates are tending to be slightly biased towards vertebrate groups. That said, there are insect monitoring schemes that exist. In Europe, where I am now, we have a European grassland butterfly indicator, and that shows similar long-term declines in species. So, yeah, a range of data sources that we can piece together for a robust picture on the state of our nature.
Yeah, I mean, protecting biodiversity isn't just for diversity's sake. What is the actual damage or risk that is caused when species disappear and we lose biodiversity?
So the loss of biodiversity is quite frightening in terms of the food we eat. So lots of our food is imported, and even the food that we grow internally relies on high quality soil. And loss of species like bees, hoverflies, threaten the pollination of certain fruit and vegetables. We're more likely to get pests if we lose biodiversity because natural enemies like ladybirds and spiders often eat pests. And then we rely more on chemical pesticides, which could have impacts on our health or sometimes fail because other species become resistant. So big impact of food. Health, of course, many diseases like COVID are thought to be more likely when we degrade nature. When we cut down forests, for example, for cattle ranching, we're increasing the exposure to many of these wildlife diseases that could enter the food chain and impact human populations. Many other reasons as well link to nature decline, such as wildfires, water quality. So, yeah, lots of reasons to worry when we start seeing these figures on the decline of nature.
I mean, when you're looking at something as complex and worrisome as biodiversity loss, it's kind of hard to know for a layperson where to start. What is being discussed at this conference in terms of concrete steps?
This is one of a series of conferences. The earlier conference in 2022 led to a set of targets, quite aspirational. So things like trying to preserve 30% of our land, fresh water and sea by 2030. So the so-called 30 by 30 target. Another target is reducing invasive species by a half by 2030. And another one is to eliminate subsidies that damage nature and instead try to divert funding towards restoring nature. Seems quite obvious, but a lot of money goes towards industries that actually have a damaging effect on nature. So these are big aspirational targets. And this conference of the parties, this COP16 in Cali in Colombia, Each country, up to 200 countries, will be outlining how they will implement these targets. And the implementation is key because we can map out protected areas, but unless we do effective action within those, then they're just protected zones on paper rather than real action.
I mean, the 2030 goal is a super ambitious one. Do you think it's realistic that it'll be reached in 5 years?
Well, the last goals for 2020 and 2010 were not met. So my slightly pessimistic projection would be that we will struggle to reverse the decline of biodiversity by 2050 or even by 2030, as some of the more aspirational targets are talking about. Mm. But keep going, because the less we do, the more the impacts are going to be on us in terms of many of these nature-related risks that I talked about: disease, food insecurity, poor water quality. So it's in our own benefit to act as much as we can. And I think actually I sound a bit pessimistic there, but we have to have the optimism that we can change these systems. Because really, at the end of the day, these systems, our economies, our justice and legal systems, they're all made up of our worldviews collectively. So if we can change those worldviews, we can really transform those systems. And I think that's the challenge, is winning the hearts and minds about the need to act sustainably for our own benefit and those of our children.
That was ecologist Tom Oliver, who's been following the COP16 summit on conserving biodiversity hosted by Columbia. He's a professor of applied ecology at the University of Reading in the United Kingdom. Mozambique is on edge. Two leaders of the political opposition there were assassinated over the weekend. And if that wasn't unsettling enough, a recent presidential election is disputed, and people in the southern African nation are anxiously waiting for results. Independent candidate Venancio Mondlane says the vote was rigged. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has more.
Today's funeral for Elvino Diaz drew thousands of mourners. He was assassinated over the weekend. The church on the outskirts of Maputo was too small to hold the crowd. Diaz was the lawyer for the opposition candidate who claims the presidential election was stolen from him. Diaz was supposedly getting ready to challenge the election results in court when he and another member of the opposition were gunned down in their car. Professor Adriano Navunga, director of Mozambique's Center for Democracy and Human Rights, said the killings were a warning designed to intimidate anyone demanding transparency in the polls. He says they want to silence the fight for electoral justice. This is a struggle for each and every one of us Mozambicans. Mozambique has been ruled by one party, Frelimo, for the past 50 years since the country gained independence from Portugal. And even before this election, the party has been accused of using violence, harassment, and threats to stay in power, which it denies. Amelia Colombo of the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., says voters are growing disenchanted.
I think there's a lot of frustration with economics and unemployment.
65% of the population lives below the poverty line.
There's this sense that Mozambique is such a resource-rich country that they had been doing okay, and then they kind of hit the skids with this really major corruption scandal that put a bit of a cramp on the economy as well.
Frelimo has been trying to contain the fallout. Then this year, the party is facing a new threat: opposition candidate Venancio Mondlane, the candidate who was represented by Diaz.
He's younger, he's popular with the youth, he's charismatic, and he has the support of this party, Podemos, which is a breakaway from Frelimo and has a message that resonates with the youth.
Podemos literally means "we can" in Portuguese. It's a message of hope and encouragement. Mondlane's rallies drew young, boisterous crowds. Here they're singing the party slogan, "Save Mozambique, the country is ours." Mozambique's election commission is still counting votes. Everyone expects Frelimo to be the winner and its candidate Daniel Chapo to be declared the new president. Opposition parties say there's been massive fraud, and foreign election observers have reported irregularities both in the lead-up to the vote and on election day. Janae Cox went to Mozambique as part of the delegation from the International Republican Institute.
Some of the concerns that we have were inflated voter rolls, particularly in Frelimo, the ruling party's strongholds. In some provinces, 100 or 100 plus, maybe even up to 150% more people registered than were actually thought to exist.
That suggests illegal votes were being cast. Her group found other red flags, too.
One of our observers in Nampula saw a female election official had in their hands pre-marked Frelimo ballots, which raised concerns about potential ballot stuffing and electoral fraud.
The final results are expected later this week and could set off more violence. Mozambicans are bracing themselves while international observers are calling for, quote, the utmost restraint by all. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Until this week, if you went to a particular pizza shop in Düsseldorf, Germany, you'd find the classic cheese, the margarita, sausage and onion, and then there was the number 40 pie, much more popular than the others. It came with a special side dish.
Eine Pizza mit extra Kick. Die gab's
that extra kick was not hot peppers or extra onions. Nope, it was cocaine.
Und dann hat man vorportioniertes Kokain bekommen anstelle einer Pizza.
That's criminal director Michael von Moltke speaking with broadcaster RTL. He says police got a tip about the shady pizza place this past spring from suspicious food inspectors. Eventually, they went to the pizzeria manager's apartment to have a little chat. That's when the 36-year-old suspect apparently threw a bag of illegal drugs out the window, which police say fell right into the arms of the officers outside the building.
Nachdem wir bei dem Betreiber der Pizzeria 1,6 Kilogramm Kokain und 268
Moltke says the cops found 3.5 pounds of cocaine, 14 ounces of weed, and nearly $300,000 in cash. After the suspect was released from detention a few days later, number 40 was back on the menu. Investigators used this to their advantage, and they followed the money. This week, they busted a major drug ring in western Germany. Three people were arrested, plus the pizzeria manager nabbed trying to flee the country. Police have not said how much the business was charging for a number 40, but most certainly more than extra cheese. Russia is getting troop reinforcements for its war in Ukraine, and they're coming from North Korea. U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin confirmed that North Korean soldiers have joined the Russian military campaign. But what they're doing exactly remains to be seen, says the secretary. Jenny Town is the director of 38 North, which analyzes North Korea's every move. Jenny, what do we know about the arrival of North Korean troops on Russia's side in Ukraine?
So the reports so far are there have been at least 3,000 troops that are already in sort of the frontline areas in Russia, and some 10,000 or so troops that are preparing to go, that are presumably training somewhere in Russian Far East at the moment. The reports coming out from U.S. government has said, we don't know exactly what they're doing there yet. But, you know, the presumption is if they're being sent to the front lines that eventually they're going to help fight on Russia's side of the war in Ukraine as it expands into Russian territory.
So you said some are training in the Far East, but on the front in the West. I mean, what do we know about how the troops actually got from Pyongyang to the front?
There's been some reports that the Russian Navy picked up some of them. I would assume some went by train because there is one rail connection between North Korea and Russia. Others probably were sent by boat, either North Korean or Russian.
So if they're ground troops mainly, what do we know about their capabilities?
There's been some reports that have said some of the first groups that went were special forces. There's been some, you know, anecdotal reporting coming out of Ukraine and other places that the Russians are saying the North Korean soldiers are smart, they're strong, they're willing, but they're just not well-versed in modern warfare, you know, especially when it comes to things like drone attacks. If they have been trained, they've been trained on more conventional, you know, artillery systems, that kind of stuff.
How much sense does it make strategically for North Korea's Kim Jong-un to be sending troops directly into combat in Ukraine?
It makes perfect sense. They upgraded relations in June with a new comprehensive strategic partnership treaty that did have a mutual defense clause that would be triggered by if either country was attacked. And so when Ukraine actually started attacking Russian territory and expanding the war and escalating the war in Ukraine into Russian space, this is really what the turning point was. So before that, you had both sides, both Ukraine and Russia, receiving material support from their allies and partners. But now, you know, Russia has invoked this treaty and the North Koreans are sending troops to help as well. And everything that North Korea sends, you know, it doesn't come free.
Right.
So, you know, it's not out of the goodness of their heart. Certainly, yes, there are the legal obligations under the treaty that they just signed. There's some talk already that Russia will pay for these forces. So there's potentially hard currency coming, but also just, you know, the more North Korea helps in Russia's hours of need, the more indebted Russia will be to North Korea in the long run, which can have political, economic, and military benefits. On what level, you know, nobody knows. But so there's political support. Russia has also been opening pathways for North Korea to get more involved with BRICS activities. And, you know, the biggest concern on the South Korean side, for instance, in the U.S. side, is what more might Russia be willing to do in terms of military technology assistance to North Korea, especially in their WMD and missiles?
Well, I was about to ask you, what could this mean for North Korea's nuclear program? Because Russia has a serious arsenal and know-how when it comes to nukes.
Absolutely. And, you know, first, you shouldn't underestimate what the North Koreans can accomplish on their own, because they certainly have been making advancements on their own
right.
at a pretty phenomenal pace in the past, you know, 5 years. But with Russian assistance, if they're willing to help on, say, for instance, ICBM technologies, booster technologies, fissile material production, those kinds of things, it can definitely accelerate North Korea's timeline.
Yeah, and what do you see as the risk of the West characterizing this war as expanding, dare I say it, a world war?
Well, you know, there's a lot of nuclear states here. And certainly Russia has threatened to use nuclear weapons in the past if NATO got involved, directly involved. I know there's, you know, Russian characterization of what it would mean even for Ukraine to get U.S. permission to use the long-range missiles to strike Russian territory. Like, all of these things are really pushing the war in a very dangerous direction. And one where, when you have multiple nuclear weapon states on both sides of the equation, it really increases the chances of conflict really moving into a very dangerous phase and potential nuclear use.
Jenny Town is the director of 38 North, a program at the Stimson Center that tracks North Korea. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The impact of the brutal civil war in Sudan continues to spill over into neighboring countries. In just 1 week this month, some 25,000 people, most of them women and children, trekked across the border into eastern Chad looking for safety. Will Carter is the Sudan country director for the Norwegian Refugee Council. He met many of those new arrivals.
There's been heartbreaking stories of people leaving, many left because of just brutal violence, both sexual violence towards them or family members. You know, we're seeing people who are trying to escape from besieged cities, especially in North Darfur, which have been bombarded as well as blockaded, and just having to walk for days with not all their family members and not much left, and arriving into what is already an overcrowded and pretty underfunded response. It's just been months of heartbreak.
Meanwhile, the nation of South Sudan is also struggling to take care of war refugees from its neighbor. It's also facing one of its worst flood seasons since it became a country in 2011. Dr. Mohamed Bashir is witnessing the twin catastrophes up close. He works with Doctors Without Borders and has been caring for patients on the border and inside the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, for the past year. He spoke with The World's Carolyn Beeler from Twitch County in South Sudan.
Dr. Bashir, I know that the rains have been unrelenting. What does that flooding mean for people who have fled across the border, who are displaced, who may be living in camps, as well as local residents where you are right now? What are conditions like?
South Sudan, unfortunately, is one of the most affected countries globally now by climate change. And South Sudan has been actually struck by constant floods for almost 4 years in a row now. And we're experiencing a flooding now and seeing people who are already displaced, losing already what little they have now to the flood. I think it's very harsh. These are very harsh conditions. The people who crossed from Sudan seeking refuge here, they didn't find it also, because if there's no war, but still the natural conditions are not favorable.
What does that look like? Are there displaced persons camps that have actually been flooded out and people have had to leave?
Yes. Well, actually, I've seen one of the inhabitants of this internally displaced camp. He was sleeping, and in the morning, he woke up to be surrounded with water everywhere, even inside his own hut he was living in.
Wow. How deep was the water?
Well, up to the ankles, but of course, it's increasing by the hour. It's increasing, and it's projected to keep rising maybe up to the mid of November and before it starts to recede again.
So farms are flooded, as well as that displaced persons camp that you mentioned.
Yes.
What are the streets like there? Is it flooding all over?
Some places actually are already inaccessible now by road. There are some isolated islands of land which are high grounds. People are moving there using boats. Some of the people I've heard to leave their village, they were going walking into water up to their waists just to leave their villages in this area here in Twitch County.
Wow. Dr. Bashir, I'd love it if you could zoom in on the story of one patient that you have treated that has really stuck with you.
Back in September, while we were working in the capital, Khartoum, 5 months into the conflict, I was in the hospital in the emergency room. Suddenly we received a 13-year-old. He was almost unconscious, severely dehydrated. The caretaker said that he was suffering from vomiting and diarrhea since the night before. So immediately rang to the team that this might be a cholera outbreak. And not an hour later, we received 4 more patients.
Wow.
And when we tested, it was unfortunately a cholera outbreak. So that patient, fortunately, he had a good outcome because we reacted very fast. We started to rehydrate. And then in a matter of hours, we set up an isolation for treating cholera patients, which we kept on doing for the next 3 months in Khartoum.
You said that some 70% of the country's health infrastructure was no longer operating. I imagine that means you have to improvise and provide care in situations where you don't have all the equipment that you need. Can you tell me a story about that?
Health workers in Sudan are actually staying back in these conflict-affected areas and working with very limited resources. They managed actually to help save countless lives using donations from Sudanese in the diaspora. No big donors are helping them, actually.
You said that people in Sudan are really having to improvise. What does that look like? What type of resources or equipment do they not have that they usually do?
In Sudan, the health system was very strong. People who had renal failure and who were required to have dialysis sessions. All over Sudan, this treatment was offered for free of charge. We had more than 50 dialysis centers all over Sudan before the war. Even for cancer patients in Sudan, the treatment for all kinds of cancers was free in Sudan. Now, after a year and a half into the war, all of this has been lost. And there are some examples, like in Darfur, where the community, the inhabitants of the city, with the help of their own expats and Sudanese diaspora, they managed to operate one of the kidney dialysis centers on their own without the help from any organization, without the help of the Ministry of Health, but they managed to operate it. It's just a miracle.
Wow. You and your family lived in Sudan's capital, Khartoum. I know that you were able to get your wife and children out of the country shortly after the war began. Can you imagine returning to Sudan with your family? Is that something you allow yourself to think about?
I always tell myself that I would not give up. I will always have hope. But in the near future, I don't see that, going back with the family and having the lives that we had before the 15th of April, 2023, to be honest.
I hear a lot of sadness in your voice when you talk about that not being possible, at least in the short term.
Sudan has been an unstable country for many years now. 20 years ago, we had the conflict in Darfur. So it took it 50 years to reach the capital and the heart of Sudan. So I think lots of generations are responsible for this. And now I think this generation has the responsibility to answer the question of how we can live peacefully together as Sudanese.
Dr. Mohamed Bashir, he works with Doctors Without Borders, caring for refugees who fled the war in Sudan. He spoke with my co-host, Carolyn Beeler, from Twitch County, South Sudan. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Marco Werman, as always. Thank you for listening.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the Ford Foundation. By the Henry Luce Foundation. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Noor Hall and Roger Hale, Lisa and Peter Krause, Carla Martin, Frank Washington, and Lizzie and Daniel Routman. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. From PRX.